Thank you, David, for that kind introduction. My understanding of the remit of these talks is that they are supposed to be not for the experts in the audience, who should leave as soon as it's decent, but for the non-experts. It's a survey I've prepared of the, really an answer to the question, why should you ever think there was a connection between black holes on the one hand and information on the other? And as we go through the reasons for that, we will touch upon the sorts of topics and questions which this program is aiming to address. It's a great pleasure to be speaking here on this topic. I attended, I think, the second of the programs at this institute when it was under the directorship of Walter Cohn back in 1980. And I have to confess that many of the things that we've been talking about have a certain resonance with those in those days. But another constant has been the weather. It was extraordinarily wet that spring because of an El Nino event which sort of washed down the canyons, and it seems to have been quite wet, at least over the weekend. That having been said, let me give you a rough plan. I don't know whether I'll get through all of this. My aim is that the non-experts should know roughly what the basic ideas are in the subject. Perhaps remember the odd formula, although we won't be doing any derivations. And to understand anything, you need to understand classical black holes, but in particular, the many analogues which were found in the past with thermodynamics. However, in order to make progress and in order to understand what's going on and how this analogy can be made more concrete, we have to pass from the classical to the quantum. And historically, at least, that passage was done via semi-classics by considering fixed backgrounds and thinking of quantum fields propagating around them. And the basic message here is that the classical analogues at the level that we study them become identities, that there are very, very strong reasons for believing that black holes behave just like regular thermodynamic systems. So this is because of a phenomenon known as Hawking evaporation, and it involves such topics as black hole remnants and quantum entanglement. So I'll mention a few ideas or aspects of this. Now, at that time, ideas about quantum gravity were rather imprecise. People had begun to calculate one-loop corrections. In pure gravity, we knew that one-loop corrections to Einstein's theory were harmless. But there was a great deal of enthusiasm for supergravity as a possible way of taming those divergences. And what is striking, at least to me, is that black holes and supergravity fit like a hand in a glove. There are some beautiful aspects of the general theory of supersystems which apply absolutely on the nose to the theory of classical black holes. And this goes under the name of BPS, or extreme black holes. And two phrases should be borne in mind in this concept. If you know anything about algebra, and in particular superalgebras, A key idea is the idea of a central charge, a very mysterious object, and a historical reference back to Johnny Wheeler. For those that have read his books and papers, you'll be thinking, charge without charge. Flux lines trapped in the topology of space was how he thought about this. So there are some, you can make a great deal of progress at this sort of level, but eventually most people decided that pure supergravity theories are not the route to quantum gravity, or rather they are a route, but it's not the final stage. We have to go beyond that. And for many people, going beyond that means going to string theory. Now, I'm not necessarily saying string theory is the only answer, and it's certainly in its present form not the final answer, but it is an extremely promising area. And on the basis of that, of course, people have convinced themselves that we in principle have a perturbative quantum theory of gravity. But that perturbative expansion is not sufficient to grasp the full depths of the theory, and what comes into that theory are non-perturbative excitations. And those excitations in general are known as brains, and it turns out that brains and black holes are very closely related. And moreover, given that fact, it's been possible to count the number of states associated with macroscopic black holes, mainly of the BPS type, and that agrees with the thermodynamic properties which I'm about to explain found classically. So I'll be talking about brains and black holes. And the word here is microstate counting. Now, brains have nice, have interesting properties. They behave a bit like black holes. Near black hole, near the horizon of these BPS black holes, things look very much like anti-De Sitter space, and this has led to the idea that we can, or there exists a certain correspondence to a number of people, but principally Maldacena is the one who's developed it most, that there is something called the ADS-CFT correspondence, and this is related to the notion of holography, the notion that degrees of freedom or information, I'm using these in an extremely vague way, these words, reside not in the bulk of some system but on its boundary. So this has also reinforced our conviction that there is a deep connection between ideas of holography and ideas of black holes. You could say that the original suggestion came from this direction. And then finally, I want to say a bit about, well, ADS stands for anti-De Sitter. That's a space-time with a cosmological constant, which is negative. But all of this is all very theoretical. I want, finally, at the end of the talk, to discuss the real application of these ideas to the origin and nature of the universe. And to do that, I have to switch signs. I want to be talking about the De Sitter horizons and the topic of inflation. Well, that's the menu. How far I get, I'm not too sure. It's quite ambitious, obviously, but I won't be able to say too much. I want just to convey the buzzwords and the simple ideas so that you see there's something in what we're trying to say. Now, let's start with topic one, which is gravitational collapse and the theory of black holes. Black holes goes back quite a way. The first paper on this was written in 1784. If you want to look it up, you can go to NASA ADS and type in the name Mitchell and the date 1784, and it'll come up and you can read it. It's a fantastic paper in which, using the ballistic theory of light, Mitchell, after conversations with Cavendish, decided that, or realized that, if an object of mass m was compressed within a radius, I'm using high precision here, including the number, but given by that formula, then light can't escape from it. Such an object would have a gravitational field, which you can easily estimate. I'm going to call that kappa, not little g, to be, well, it's gm over r squared, so if r is given by that, it's going to be c to the fourth divided 4 gm. So these formulae are all you need to know, really, about black holes. They have a size given by a radius, which you could estimate from Newtonian theory, and turns out to be the exact result. And they have in their neighborhood the local value of the gravitational acceleration, and it's given by this formula. And of course, these are deduced from an inconsistent theory of gravity, but because the theory of light and gravity was not satisfactory at that time, these ideas were completely forgotten after Thomas Young had revived and vindicated Huygens' wave theory of light. We had to wait until general relativity, which is our best consistent theory of the interactions of light and gravity, before they were incorporated. But even then, it took a long time. It wasn't until the early 70s that what we now think of as the standard picture, the modern synthesis, that gravitational collapse and black holes were properly understood. And the key concept that was needed here is the idea of an event horizon. So I want to draw a diagram to illustrate this, and this diagram is probably the most important thing that you have to remember apart from the formula. You can work out the formula, of course, very easily. We're going to consider a star which begins in a static state, runs out of nuclear fuel, and begins to collapse inwards. And for certain masses, masses bigger than, for example, the Chandrasekhar limit or some very large perturbation in the center of a galaxy, there'll be nothing that can stop it from falling inwards classically and forming a singularity. Now, as it does so, we're going to ask what happens to light as it escapes or begins to escape from the stars, because what we're going to be looking at, the event horizon, is should be thought of as the last wavefront to escape. Note, I'm already considering a time-dependent situation, which it's very important to bear in mind when thinking about these things. So the basic idea is that if you consider a flash of light moving outwards at early times, let's put it in orange, it escapes. Excuse me, that's meant to escape. but if you think of it at late times, it gets bent and it fails to escape. All of these are light-like surfaces. So, of course, you expect that there'll be an intermediate situation, and the intermediate situation will look something like this. So here it's stationary. Well, actually, I'm going to color code it. I'll put a green, I guess, if I can remember. So that's a stationary wavefront. And it is the event horizon. So inside here, you can't get out classically because you'd have to travel faster than light. That's the basic, simple concept. All that. Let's start. Now the radius is given by this formula, and outside here there's a measure of the gravity. This is sort of slightly renormalized notion of gravity, but it's the one that's relevant. And what you also observe is that at least it's plausible from the picture that you can think of a cross-section of this wavefront. In a spherical case, that's an expanding sphere. And it's pretty clear that it's increasing. And indeed, that's the general property. A final is bigger, at least, but most equal to A initial. So that's, if you like, A final, that's A initial. And it's a monotonic process. The reason for that is each of these, if you just consider the rays associated with this, it's a bunch of rays, and they're getting converged by gravity. Now, if they actually are converging, because energy is always positive, they'll always converge. That's a simple result. So they cannot be converging in order to get out to infinity. They must be diverging. But if they're diverging, then the area has got to increase. So inevitably, there is a non-decreasing function associated with gravitational collapse. Now, this thing is supposed to settle down to a final state, and calculations show there are such final states. These final states are independent of time, and they are stable. So there's a final equilibrium, and there's something called the no-hair theorem. Which in four dimensions is a rigorous theorem. Final state depends on just, well, I'll call it three, you could make it four, depending on your theory. I'll explain that in a moment. Three quantities. The mass or energy of the system, its angular momentum, because we could make the whole thing spin. And one or more charges. Let's suppose we just have a theory with electric charges. We can add in magnetic charges, and you can think of hypothetical theories with lots of charges. So just three numbers characterize whatever you started from. So what we're finding is that there is a distinguished, unique final state parameterized by just three numbers. And during the process, something increases with time. I should say these parameters are subject to an inequality, which I'll write down. Well, in the units I'm using, it's a rather strange formula, but what it is. So you get to pick them as long as they satisfy this inequality. And black holes which are on the boundary of this inequality are called extreme. Now, toward each of these black holes, you can associate a radius, the formula is a bit more complicated, and a surface gravity. I won't give you the formula, but the key point about that is that the surface gravity is zero for the extreme case. What's happening here is, if the thing is rotating, centrifugal forces overwhelm gravity, you just can't have a black hole. If you put charge in, the ordinary repulsive effects overwhelm gravity, you can't have a black hole. So there's a boundary between the objects which are black holes and which are not. And those are the ones that are associated with this BPS condition when we pass to supergravity. Okay, now, these horizons are fairly tricky things, and so here is the thing I want to say to the experts, so that they will know it. In order to define this horizon, you need to know what happens for all of time. They are highly non-local. They're tricky in that respect. You can't put your finger on a horizon. We may ourselves be inside one at this moment. We would never know. So they're an artificial construct. Another way to say it is, if you believe in Hamiltonian mechanics, you'll have a hard time dealing with horizons because they're not easily described if you have a uniform flow of time. From the point of view of Lagrangian physics, it's not a problem because in Lagrangian physics we look at the entire evolution of our system, and so you just ask that you want light rays satisfying a teleological boundary condition. That is not what we normally do in all our other areas of physics. They're tricky also for another reason, which I want to show you, and that's this. Supposing, I've got to draw another diagram, so I'll do it here. Supposing you have a black hole, or sorry, a collapsing star, and it collapses. Okay, so you begin to get what you think is a horizon. And so you say, well, there's a black hole. Is that really true? Well, the answer is no, because at any moment, you could throw in some more matter. If you did that, this would start to converge. Remember, it's on the boundary between converging and diverging. Any positive energy causes it to focus. So this guy has to hurtle into here. What that means is the true horizon is nowhere where you thought it was. It had to start earlier and be over here. So the horizon, if you think of it as evolving in time, jumps around in a crazy way. You can't keep track of it locally, even classically. This is not a problem in quantum mechanics, and obviously even more puzzling in quantum mechanics. So this is a non-local object. In fact, it's teleological. Now, in quantum gravity, things get even worse. Because in quantum gravity, there are no local observables at all. So you're going to find an even more difficult time describing this in a local fashion. The only observables in quantum gravity are global, because we're always allowed to do diffeomorphisms. That's a separate thing from this. This is just because you've defined a thing to be highly non-local. Okay, so now we're beginning to see that this thing has the smell of thermodynamics. Let me say a few more things. So this area, which is a complicated formula in general, it's convenient to introduce something called an irreducible mass, concept used by Dimitris Christodoulou. If we had a Schwarzschild black hole, that would be the regular mass. Now this guy is not going to decrease with time. That's the consequence of this theorem proved by Stephen Hawking. So it's an irreducible mass, and I want you to think about the formula in special relativity, where in classical relativity, without decay, particle decays, we have a formula which says that the mass is equal to the irreducible bit, known as the rest mass, plus a piece which is kinetic. This is extractable, this is not, classically. Of course, if you make the thing decay and do other things, it's a slightly different story. We can break up the mass of our black hole into similar contributions. There's a formula whose precise nature isn't important, but I'd like to write it down just to make this clear that it's very concrete. So the energy available to us, free energy if you like, is composed of energy we can't do anything about, plus electrostatic potential energy, which we could extract by putting in charges or making the electric field do some work, and rotational kinetic energy, which is the analog of this guy. So this is a very close analogy with thinking about the free energy of a system. And now you see this irreducible is like something which is not decreasing. In fact, we will later be saying that this is up to a factor 4 or so, the entropy of our system. So this is like expressing the energy as a function of entropy, which can only increase and adiabatically remains constant, plus other contributions. Now that formula can be differentiated and you get the last item in the classical theory of black holes. Which is the first law. We find that if you were to change the parameters of a stable final state, then you get a formula of the following sort. This is the electrostatic potential of the black hole. I won't give the formula. This is the electrostatic work done when you change the parameters, or obtained when you change the parameters. This is the angular velocity, so this is the kinetic energy term, which occurs in every thermodynamic system. And by golly, what's this? Well, it sort of looks like TDS. It has all of the classical properties of an entropic system. And the question is, what is S and what is T? Well, one guess would be that S is some function of A, monotonic increasing. And T, therefore, is some function of kappa. But, of course, you have to adjust it. Because, as you all know in thermodynamics, the notion, if you just have an expression like TdS, you need a temperature scale to measure T, or alternatively, an entropy unit to measure entropy. It's not defined simply by saying that that's positive. In ordinary thermodynamics, we use an ideal gas. That's the usual definition in the undergraduate books. We couple the system to something we know about, and that determines what the precise formula is. So how can we do this in our case? Well, we don't really want an ideal gas because that's classical, but we can choose something quantum mechanical. We couple to a quantum field. Now that leads me to the semi-classic of these objects. what we do is we consider a quantum field on this background. We assume that this is a background which is given to us. This is physically inconsistent, as we shall see, but it's the first stage of an approximation procedure. We imagine, let us say, photons, quantized photons moving on this background. And we say, well, what would happen if we had initially some vacuum state? So there's nothing there at all. Now, in the vacuum, we always have the production of pairs. Even photon pairs get produced out of the vacuum. And so you could expect a process of this sort. Let's suppose, perhaps they're not photons, but particles, so you can really think of them as electrons, for example, with an arrow. Now, this is an almost perfect absorber, classically. So there's a good chance that this particle can fall in and this particle can escape. And that's what was found in a beautiful calculation by Hawking. So here we get quantum mechanical. In vacuum can be expressed in terms of two other vacua, the space of states which go out and the space of states which go in. And in general, that will be a complicated sum. It'll be a tensor product, or sum of tensor products of outgoing states with ingoing states. And they'll be inextricably entangled. Oh, this is an entangled state. Now, what do we do with such a state? If we are interested in making measurements at large distances away from the hole, we'll have to trace over the states we don't observe. And so, as in all areas of quantum mechanics, we'll get a partial density matrix. So tracing is partial density matrix. In order to calculate that, what we have to bear in mind is the process of particle creation is really changing a basis in your space of states. It's very analogous to choosing different quasi-particle states in a solid state system, for example, a condensed matter system. You have to compute what are called Bogoliubov coefficients. You have to say, suppose I have a positive frequency wave here, which is going to be one of the elements of my ingoing state. I pass it up to infinity, and I see what composition it has. Because of the time dependence in general, it will be a combination of positive and negative frequencies. That's why I insist on the time dependence. You can't understand what's going on unless you really think of time-dependent systems. Now, the particles that get out to infinity at late times hover for a long time here. Their redshifts are very large. In fact, that's a technical problem with this way of proceeding, which I will explain shortly. So, in general, you do this classical calculation, taking into account that redshift. I won't do it on the board. And that will tell you what the elements of this density matrix are. So, in the approximation we're dealing with, this gives a Gibbsian density matrix. In other words, it's a thermal density matrix associated with the outgoing states. And associated with that is a temperature. And here is the magic formula. KT is given by all black holes that we know about, h bar kappa over 2 pi c. So the surface gravity determines the temperature. In fact, there's an analog of this statement in ordinary flat space. If you consider an accelerated observer, then actually, if you decompose the Minkowski vacuum state in this way, you'll see that the observer will see a distribution of particles with so-called Unruh temperature given by the acceleration. This is just the acceleration. They're locally, or semi-locally, more or less the same. Now, if you actually translate this for the ordinary spherically symmetric black holes, you get a formula which is like this. So we've now actually fixed what the temperature is. And since the temperature is proportional to kappa, we've now also fixed what the entropy is. So the final part of this way of thinking about the connection between black holes is that the black hole entropy has to be consistent at the large semi-classical level given by this formula. Now, this formula can be reinterpreted in a simple way. The Planck length, we haven't used so far, is given by h bar g over c cubed to the 1/2. The Planck length is the Compton wavelength of, if you think of an object whose schwarzschild radius equals its Compton wavelength, that's the factor 2, then that object will have the Planck mass and will have the Planck scale. So if we reorganize this formula here, left out of 4, what we actually get is that this is Boltzmann's constant A over 4 Lp squared. And this is the beginning of speculations about holography. They go back a long way. Even in the 70s, people were talking about this sort of idea. You see, we're trying to think of this formula as, in some sense, related to the kind of formulae we would normally use. For example, we might be tempted to use Boltzmann's formula. Actually, it's not really Boltzmann. It's probably Planck, which associates entropy with the number of states of a system at fixed energy. So this formula should be thought of as the entropy as a function of the charges and the mass and the angular momentum. So Boltzmann, of course, was a classical man, but the quantum mechanical equivalent of Boltzmann's statement is that. So that makes a certain sort of sense because of the following geometrical picture. Here's our horizon, thought of as a sphere. We're cutting it at one time, and then we just break it up into little regions, just as we do with a map of the world. If those regions are of length Lp, then the number of those regions is just given by A over Lp squared up to a factor of pi or so. So if we can, in that small little volume there, or area there, if we can lose an amount of information of one bit, or if we can encode the amount of information one bit, in terms of orders of magnitude, this is an explanation for the funny formula. So, in other words, at the semi-classical level, we can argue that the entropy of this black hole is some measure of the, in quotes, information, because I didn't define it, lost during the collapse and then liberated later. Now, the final step in this chain of arguments, so I've not put anybody's names to these chain of arguments, they're now classic, you can look them up in the literature. The last chain of steps in these semi-classical arguments is the generalized Second law. Okay, so obviously, as you put stuff into this black hole, this could have some entropy. Almost certainly would if it were a star. And it's lost to the outside world, in some sense. But we don't like losing entropy because we think there ought to be a compensating effect, and that the second law of thermodynamics should hold for everybody. If that is true, well, this area increase should compensate the entropy decrease. Moreover, as this black hole evolves, I haven't spoken of its evolution, if it's going to emit particles, it's going to lose energy, its area will go down, but particles in a thermal state will be liberated. So again, you can hope that the total entropy is certainly non-decreasing, and so the generalized second law would be that the entropy of black holes plus the entropy of matter is non-decreasing. Okay. Now, I haven't spoken much about taking this procedure beyond this level, but I want to say a few words about that and what it leads to before we get on to the BPS states. So I'm running quite tightly, but I think I have at least 5 minutes beyond because I started slightly late. Okay, now you will see from these formulae that the temperature of our black hole is inversely as the mass. That means that as you decrease the mass, the temperature goes up as it loses energy, and that means the specific heat is negative. That's a very strange phenomenon, but it's universal. Any gravitating system for which gravity dominates will have that property. That's what makes the stars shine, and that's what makes the world go around. So it's an inevitable consequence of gravity. It's true for these black holes without charges. It ceases to be true when we're near extremality, and I will come back to that in a moment. Now, normal expectation of what will happen in this case is that if there is nothing outside to prevent it, a black hole will ultimately radiate all of its energy away, or at least it will decrease its size over the regime in which this is a good approximation. Who knows what happens towards the end when it will get very small. That's an explosive process. The only thing that can stop it is to put a box around the outside and confine the radiation. And then you can begin to investigate what that would mean in terms of an equilibrium between the outgoing radiation and the black hole itself. If you can construct a model in which there is such an equilibrium, then you will have measured the temperature in the same way that in the lab you'd measure the temperature by coupling a system to an ideal gas or some thermometer whose properties you knew about. Now that turns out to be very straightforward. So far I have not done anything about quantizing gravity, but we can begin to see what quantizing gravity would introduce, what changes would be introduced if we did, by looking at a path integral quantization, if you like. We will say that semi-classically the partition function, which is something that we'd be interested in computing, is some sort of path integral over metrics. Now, in thermodynamics, it's well known that the partition function for an ordinary thermodynamic system at temperature T is given by a path integral, if you choose to use path integral methods, over trajectories, histories, which are periodic in the inverse of the temperature. That just comes because you take the trace of e to the minus beta h, you think of e to the minus beta h as moving forward in imaginary time, and since it's a trace, it's a cyclic process, and so all path integrals in ordinary thermodynamics can be thought in that way. And in quantum field theory, you do the same thing. Quantum field theory can be thought of as a special case of thermodynamics, except the fields live on four-dimensional Euclidean space. And when you work out the partition function, it's just as if you were working out the zero temperature generating function. Or so. If you want to do it at finite temperature, you don't work on Euclidean space, you work on three-dimensional Euclidean space and a circle for time, and then you decompose into the Matsubara bound frequencies. So we can do exactly the same thing in black hole physics, and we consider some box. It's an artificial box which doesn't let things like gravitons out. We consider a black hole, and then we consider the equilibrium. Now, there are different ways of doing this, but one way which is relevant for what I'm going to say later is that, that this box had radius RB. We can look. Well, first of all, I should say that we will represent this by a Euclidean path integral. That's one way that you can proceed. And if you do so, you will find that there is a Euclidean version of the Schwarzschild solution, which is periodic in imaginary time. I don't have time to explain that in great detail, except to say that the period agrees with precisely 1 over kt that you'd expect from thermodynamics, where the t is given by the formulae that I've written down. So when you do that, you find that there are various instantons in this theory, or there may or may not be an instanton in this theory. You try to match this system you have a boundary here, you have a boundary which is the circle of temperature, and let's say S2. You try to put in a black hole, you find that you may or may not be able to match those two. You find that if the parameters are such that R is bigger than 3gm over c squared, there are two ways of matching: as an unstable and a stable black hole. And if R is less than 3gm over c squared, then there is no black hole. So what's going on here is, if you have a small system where the black hole has to be very small, very hot, it evaporates very quickly, it can't be in equilibrium with radiation. If you have a big system, then the black hole can be very big and very cool, and so can the radiation, and so there can be an equilibrium. In other words, there's a phase transition in this system. So you can draw some diagram like that, and the formula for this is given by KTR is h bar, in this case, c over 8 pi root 27. Now, I've mentioned this because this sort of calculation, these sort of calculations are down in the mid-80s, well, a bit earlier than that, but then through the mid-80s. They actually form a central part of our understanding of confinement according to the ADS-CFT correspondence. Because many years later, replacing this rather primitive box by an ADS space, I'll say a bit more about that later, an ADS space behaves like a big box. You do the same calculation. Now, according to Maldacena's ideas, the boundary theory you're describing is Yang-Mills on the boundary. You know that at high temperature you should be looking for deconfinement. There is a phase transition, and that's the phase transition that you get. I'll flesh that out later, but just to say that all of these ideas worked out in the past have come to great fruition. So this is all part of the evidence that there's something seriously going on here, that the physics is a principle understood, but it's not to say there aren't many deep questions about how you implement these things in detail. As I said earlier, we don't have a proper quantum theory of gravity without introducing strings. If we introduce strings, we have to go to non-perturbative degrees of freedom, etc., etc. And we don't really have a guarantee that much of this makes sense. So the aim of many people over the years has been to try and flesh this out with more and more reliable quantum theories of gravity. And the first reliable quantum theory of gravity, putatively, was supergravity. So I want to say a bit about BPS black holes. Now the soundbite for this is the following. Supersymmetry is a theory where the Hamiltonian is quadratic in some fermionic generators called supersymmetry generators, but possibly there's some extra term. This term commutes with everybody. That's so it's certainly in the center of the supersymmetry algebra. But what it actually means physically is that you can't change the value of this term. So it can't be like an angular momentum, and it can't be by like an electric charge. It's called a central charge. And in fact, in black holes, it's a very familiar concept. You see, if you look at these supergravity theories, take the simplest one, which would be Einstein-Maxwell theory, with a bunch with two Majorana fermions. To say that the fermions are Majorana is to say they carry no electric charge. The graviton certainly carries no electric charge, and since it's an abelian theory, the photon carries no electric charge. So if it happened that there was some flux coming out of a black hole, it could only be for topological reasons, and only because it was put there, either from the very beginning or maybe by some tunneling process. And if you have that charge, then the only thing that can happen to the black hole is, as it evolves, let's take the lid off the box and let it evolve, the photons in that theory, thermal photons and thermal gravitons, will be emitted, reducing the mass, but they cannot, according to these formulae, reduce it to anything below the value where you put the J to zero, because you can radiate J. J is not a central charge. You'll be down to an interesting situation where you have N is equal to Q over root G, so-called extreme black holes. So it's a particular manifestation of a very general phenomenon. The extreme Riesz-Nordström black holes are these BPS states. What's exciting about the BPS states is that there are many arguments saying that quantum corrections to BPS states are very small, if non-existent. There are non-renormalization theorems or non-renormalization arguments. So there's an enormous advantage in focusing on these states because we can reliably calculate with them. So that's the next step in the argument. I haven't got too long to go, so I'll now talk about brains. Now the concept of a brain is a very simple idea. It's just some extended membrane-like object. Membrane is a two-brain, and we have d brains, the d dimension, so a string is a one-brain, which is extended in space, maybe in some higher dimension. Now, these things are called d brains. And we can certainly make these d-brains by considering a black hole and moving it up into the extra dimensions. Any black hole moved into flat dimensions is going to look like a brain. And because the various string theories that we're interested in live naturally in higher dimensions, or the supergravity theories, there is no doubt whatsoever, and it's vindicated by calculations, that supergravity theories, which are the low energy limit of string theory, are replete with d-brains. And if you choose d-brains of this sort, they are replete with supersymmetric d-brains. Now, how do these correspond to what happens in string theory? Well, it was realized by Ochinsky, I guess, first and most dramatically, that string theory contains fundamental strings, F strings, or F1 brains. And they can end, they can have boundary conditions in the open string theory for which these strings define a locus on which they end, and that locus is what we call a D-brain. Now, all of this is a microscopic picture of this procedure, and you can compute the microscopic properties of this picture by using the underlying string theory. You can compute the number of states with certain charges and so forth. Now, amongst the charges in string theory are these magic central charges. And they correspond to charges in string theory called Ramon-Ramon charges. It's known that these charges were in principle true, but Ramon-Ramon fields don't couple in a straightforward way to strings. So the final synthesis says that extreme black holes of certain types should be looking like EPS D-brains. So that offers the possibility of doing microscopic calculations which are more sophisticated than the one that I mentioned over here. The most famous one is due to Andy Stroninger and Kumran Baffa, but there are many more that follow. So what you do is you imagine a macroscopic D-brain, which means a macroscopic black hole with some flat directions, and then you consider moving it towards a regime in which you're going to one which a good description is by these D-brains. Because it's supersymmetric, various quantities, including the number of states, will remain constant as you do that. And therefore, you can get a handle on these macroscopic states. So there are going to be two ways of calculating the number of states. One is to count the entropy of the area of your macroscopic object, and the other is to calculate the microstates. And indeed, they were able to verify using a formula of Kabi that S does indeed equal K log N in this situation. Now, all this is very fine because of supersymmetry. One of the main topics which I hope people will be discussing here, and that many people are actively trying to push, is how can we move away from the supersymmetric state? That is the real challenge in this theory. Do we have reliable ways to compute non-perturbative effects in theories where you are a long way away from the supersymmetric situation? Now, I said that if you're an ordinary black hole, your specific heat is negative. If you're a BPS black hole or near BPS, it's actually positive. In other words, near BPS systems behave like regular thermodynamic systems. It's still a big issue in this subject whether or not there is a phase transition which separates this sort of behavior. Who knows? Some people will have faith and some people will say, well, let's see if we can calculate it. So that's one of the important questions that has arisen. Now, I don't think I'll say much about ADS and black holes except the following. Because I'm running out of time, I just want to say a few words about De Sitter shortly. In ADS, the way to think about ADS is the following. The energy of a particle at rest in ADS is given by 1 minus lambda r squared over 3, say, times its mass. Now, if lambda is negative, this energy grows with R. And basically, the way to think about living in ADS is that everybody is susceptible to a simple harmonic motion. They never get all the way out to infinity. It's a box with invisible excuse me, with invisible walls. There is a wall at infinity, there is a conformal boundary, as it's called, and you can examine the theory at large distances. Now, this is called the Tolman redshifting formula, roughly speaking, and it's telling you that energy scales vary with position in the radial direction of an AVS space. Now, what we do know from quantum field theory quite generally and statistical mechanics is the behavior of quantum field theories vary with the energy scale that you're considering. So it's very natural to consider what would happen if you make the renormalization scale direction a new coordinate. So in this theory, or in this idea, we introduce an extra coordinate. We have a system where we put things in some sort of a box. We have a theory on the boundary, which is the most extreme we can get, the ultraviolet end of the renormalization group flow. And then in the interior, we're going towards the infrared. So this is the basis of AVS CFT correspondence. And as I said earlier, what you can do is think of this box in the same way that we thought earlier of a black hole in a box. If you do so, you try to find a black hole solution. It's very straightforward to do so, and you will see a phase transition. Now, in this scenario, this is telling you something about Yang-Mills and the deconfinement transition. Now, this is again a situation of holography. Because all of the information about this system, in principle, is contained in information on the boundary. So this is a four-dimensional quantum field theory in this case, which captures the details of a bulk theory of five dimensions. So there you see again a link between black holes and, well, as I say, I don't like to use this word information because I don't really know what its definition is. I prefer to use technical terms like entropy, and then I like to be careful about whether it's Boltzmann's entropy, Gibbs's entropy, and so forth. But there is a very close connection here which needs to be fleshed out. Now, finally, I want to talk about things which are actually happening in the real world. So I'll say a few words about De Sitter space and inflation. Because many of the issues which people will be discussing in this program are really relevant to deep issues about how the universe evolved. So I said that basically living in ADS is like living in a world where everybody is attracted towards the center with a harmonic attraction. Living in De Sitter space is the opposite. Everybody is repelled. Because lambda is now positive, everybody is repelled, and so you're in a large repulsive force. And therefore, you are in a situation where you're turning inside out the situation that we had on this diagram. On this diagram, we had the situation where people were attracted into the black hole. In De Sitter space, it's the inside-out picture, that you're sitting here, and if you go too far, you'll be swept inside another horizon, called a cosmological horizon. Now, the theory can be developed in an almost precisely analogous fashion at a formal level. First, you can start with the classical theory, and the classical theory tells you that the area of this cosmological horizon which surrounds us is non-decreasing. It's given by a formula which you can easily compute in the non-rotating case. And in principle, there is entropy associated with it as well, and a temperature. So again, you can get this picture. Lambda has dimensions 1 over length squared. So this is a length squared, and then you divide by the Planck length squared. That gives you the formula. And in fact, the area is 12 pi, so the 4 comes in. And the temperature is given by formula like this. So at the classical and semi-classical level, The analogy is perfect, there's a second law, and so forth. And really, it's just that there's anti-gravity. I'll draw a picture of what Derceta space looks like, because I want to draw out the analogy between what happens during inflation and what happens in black holes. So let's take pure Derceta. Pure Derceta is a hyperboloid, so it's a surface. You can think of two-dimensional Derceta space literally as a surface, like a cooling tower. And if you're at one position on it, you can think of yourself as having a world line like this. And then because this line, this null line, is asymptotic to this, this goes on forever, obviously, this is a horizon. This is a what's sometimes called a causal horizon, because the past of this world line is bounded by this null surface. And if you're there, then you're going to lose information in the same way as a process by which information or particles can tunnel through here. And this has a certain temperature. The temperature is quite small if the cosmological constant is the big one that we see in the lab, but it, nevertheless, it's there. And so you have the same story about entangled states and so forth, and how we see what's going on. Now, I'd like to just finish by telling you what the relationship of this is to inflation, just to emphasize that the sort of issues that people are wanting to understand and get a handle on are closely related to the same issues that we have with black holes. And then I'll stop. I'm going slightly over. I hope that's all right. Yeah. Well, let's consider theories of the universe before inflation. Theories of the universe before inflation look in pictorial terms rather like this. There's some expansion. Notice this curve is convex this way, so it's decelerating expansion. It was a last scattering surface. That's where the CMB comes from. And let's say we're here. So we look back on the CMB, and we see various places on the CMB. And those places have the same temperature to high degree of precision, to 1 part in 10 to the 5. That's actually rather surprising according to old-fashioned views, because this goes back a bit. And then we have a big bang. Now, you see, this guy has a past which goes across to there. This guy has a past which goes across to there. They were never in causal contact according to this theory. So it's a puzzle why they should have the same temperature to 1 part in 10 to the 5th or so. This is one of the standard reasons for believing in inflation. How does that work in inflation? Well, you get the same, we start off with a picture like this. We go back to the last scattering surface. So we have the same set of observations here. What we actually know is that the cosmological constant eventually takes off, because we've observed the cosmological constant. So the curvature of this thing is changing. And if you believed in internal inflation, it would go on forever. Okay, so now let's look at the past bit. Well, the past bit is that you replace this by a small Derceta space. And then there's something else at the bottom here. For example, you may have a no-boundary proposal or something. So now the end of inflation is occurring somewhere like this. Let me see, have I drawn this completely how I want to? I'm sorry, I wanted to draw that like that. And here is the quasi-Derceta state. And this is last scattering. There may or may not be a big bang, but in most models people try to do without it. But now the point is that the process that we're seeing, this is the horizon, or quasi-horizon, during inflation. This generates a lot of thermal radiation. We lose information here, and we generate a thermal set of thermal fluctuations. They go outside this horizon. It's not really a horizon. They go past this null surface. But because this curve is not continuing this way, there is no horizon in this model, unless we're talking about this horizon, which is a very much later horizon, if this accelerates exponentially forever. So eventually what happens is, of course, the things do this. Radiation and interactions during reheating thermalize, and these two points therefore are naturally having the same temperature because they have been in causal contact. Now the point I'm really making is that that's exactly the same as what I said earlier. If somebody starts throwing shells on top of a black hole or over you, you've no idea where the horizon is. But the process of joining together, the process of seeing these fluctuations, which are now well verified by observation, is precisely related to the problem of what's happening to the information inside horizons and can it get out. So that's all I really want to say. I just want to point out this has been a very interesting subject. It touches every area of physics you can think of. And every time it does, it brings to, or brings from those areas of physics, really striking fundamental results. I'm sure it has a great future, and I'm sure it will have a great future in the next few months. Thank you for listening.
Okay, maybe one or two questions from people outside the program.
And for electrons that are black hole, can you actually make it explode?
No, what happens if you get the electrons inside, then they'll stay there. There will be an electric field outside. That electric field will cause pair production outside and neutralize the electric fields of the charge originally. You see, we don't ever bother about charged black holes in the real world because pair production or even the flow of macroscopic currents is so efficient. You have to be in a theory where the objects you're talking about don't couple to the electromagnetic field. That's the magic of these central fields. So what you would expect to happen in the case you mentioned is that the charge is discharged before the final evaporation, so there should be no puzzle there. However, there is a puzzle, which our chairman knows a great deal about, which is that if there are global symmetries, discrete symmetries, they cannot be conserved by the process, or at least it looks very tricky. This is the issue of remnants. Because there's no information about the global symmetries of the things inside. To put it in pictorial terms, imagine that you made a black hole out of particles which could be both red and green. So you made it out of only red particles. You would not know on the outside whether they were red or green. The thing would evaporate equally with respect to red and green, because that's by definition an exact symmetry of our theory. The outside doesn't know the difference. So in the end, you've got a large number of red particles or red charge inside, and you don't know where it will go. So there are two rough outcomes to that. Either there are remnants in the world in which you have dense systems with large global charges, or there's no such thing as a global charge. It's an anomaly in the theory. It's interesting that in string theory there are no global charges, and so this isn't a paradox, but in theories with global charges, it is a deep challenge to explain what's going on. And there has been an extensive debate, even since the 1980s, about the nature of what those remnants might be. And there are related debates about whether or not, in some sense, information or entanglement is analogous to these discrete symmetries.
Okay.
Just a very late question. How neonic living costs is given in the picture?
Well, you can try to do calculations in which the black hole's parameters change slowly. If you do that classically, it's not a difficulty. It's well understood and you can do it numerically. If you're interested in the quantum field theory aspects of it, it's not so simple. You have to do some quantum field theory in a time-dependent background with time-dependent parameters. Some attempts have been made to do mainly time-independent situations where you compute the energy momentum tensor in the vacuum state, it needs renormalization, but it's non-zero in general, and then couple it back to the geometry. And the overall picture you see is that the renormalized energy momentum tensor doesn't satisfy the standard positive energy conditions. It allows, in fact, the area to go down. It has to for consistency, and that's what's found. Indeed, in general, expectation values for the energy momentum tensor of classical theories, which ought to be positive, just violate the energy conditions. So that's most of what we know with any degree of rigor or precision, at least that's what I know about the non-equilibrium situation. And it is, of course, extremely challenging and interesting.
Okay, let's thank you.